still in the wilderness. Numbers chapter 11, please. The last 2 weeks that we've been together on Wednesday night, we've looked at the golden calf incident. The golden calf is probably, in my opinion, one of the strongest examples of transdispensational truth and application that I know of anywhere in the Old Testament. What's the message of the golden calf? That God's heart breaks every time one of his people feed their flesh in the name of religion. That's what God hates. The total syncretism. They rose up to dance and play, and they did it all in the name of the feasts of Israel. Disgusting. Then we moved on to the mixed multitude, and the lesson there is that the tares, or the ones that are extremely carnal, they're the ones that are going to, if the church gets destroyed, they're the ones that are going to do it. And so it's up to the remnant to make sure that it doesn't happen. And it will happen if it's left unchecked, the mixed multitude. That brings us now to Kadesh Barnea, Numbers 11. The story of lost opportunity, one of the saddest stories there is, really. Kadesh Barnea doesn't go down as a sad story, but it's one of the saddest, really, if you think about it. So the Jews, Israel, they've spent about a year now at Mount Sinai. They had been there just recently, brought under the Mosaic covenant, the covenant of the law. The cloud lifted, and now some... I'm pretty sure, and I've done a little bit of work on this, at least 3 million people are going to resume their journey, and they're going to be heading northward, basically, as the compass would have it. And a lot happened at Sinai, a lot of big changes. These are going to be Sinai is kind of a marker for change for these people now. They are now molded into a commonwealth. They actually have become a nation. And the dispensation, maybe the economy, not the financial economy, but the dispensation shifted now. They had been under the pure mercy of God, and now they're going to be under this law principle. God had been bearing them on eagle's wings, not imputing their trespasses against them, because there hadn't been any law pertaining to Romans 5. They didn't have anything to measure themselves by, but now they did. And so the party's over for these people. They now have a standard by which to judge things, and that standard is now in place. And God wants them to know, in fact, Paul wants them to know even worse in the book of Galatians, that the Abrahamic covenant is not going to be nullified by this new Mosaic system. Very, very important to keep in mind. The possession of the land of Canaan is going to be conditioned upon obedience. And of course, they're going to fail the test, at least initially. But ultimately, the promise, the unconditional promise of the Abrahamic covenant regarding the land is going to prevail. Up to this point, God had met all their complaining, their griping, their moaning and whining and murmuring. He met all of that with patience and an unfathomable amount of grace and mercy. But from this time on now, these sins are going to be dealt with. And dealt with big time. So the change is going to become very evident as they land up in a place called Taberah. Verse 1, Numbers 11. And when the people complained, it displeased the Lord, and the Lord heard it, and his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burnt among them, and consumed them that were in the uttermost parts of the camp. And the people cried unto Moses, and when Moses prayed unto the Lord, the fire was quenched, and he called the name of the place Taberah, because the fire of the Lord burnt among them. What a frightening thing that is. See, the party is really over now. It was at this place Taberah, where the people, the mixed multitude particularly, reveal in flying colors their true identity. All their lusting after the flesh pots of Egypt, proclaiming their hatred of the manna from heaven that God provided. They get to a place called Kibroth Hatava. And God answers their prayer, actually, and sends these quails that they literally devoured like animals. I mean, they just pounced on them as though they were some kind of emaciated animals. And they did it in such a way that they all got sick, and they wound up with a devastating plague as a result of gorging themselves on these quails. Verses 31 through 35. In fact, it was just like the psalmist says in Psalm 106, verse 14. It says, they lusted exceedingly in the wilderness and tempted God in the desert, and he gave them their request, but sent leanness into their soul. They filled their bellies full, but their hearts and that chasm that needs, that can only be filled by God, that went hungry. Then they get to a place called Hazeroth, and at Hazeroth or Hazeroth, Miriam and Aaron, of all people, start murmuring and complaining against Moses. And their issue was, why did you marry this Ethiopian? And they just read him the riot act about that. And immediately Miriam is what? Stricken with leprosy. All right. But of course her big brother prays for her, and the situation is finally cured. Really the majority of Numbers 12 is all about that family incident that was most unfortunate. Then the next movement that you have on the part of the children of Israel was to pass into an area known as the wilderness of Paran, and then finally on their way to Kadesh, where they would be on the brink of getting into the promised land. So at last, they're at the very border of their ultimate destiny. Okay, and it's taken them too long as it is. And they can almost look out across the border, and they can see that all the things that God had said about this place were true. They can see the fruit thereof in the land, as it says in chapter 13, verse 26. By now, 2 full years have passed since they were redeemed out of Egypt, first by blood and then by unfathomable power. And at long last, it looks as though salvation is right around the corner. Everything they had hoped for is going to be realized. The land is going to be theirs. The thing that they had longed for, the home of their own, is just a short distance away. But what they didn't realize is that they were in a serious, serious hour of crisis. An hour of not only crisis, the thing that made it a crisis is because it was an hour of opportunity, and there'd be a short window to take advantage of the opportunity. That then sets up a crisis. God's going to give them a little time to make up their minds what they want to do. And they have two choices, go or stay, basically. If they go forward, it would have meant for them immediate possession of the thing that God had promised them. And they, to the extent that they would have been on God's side, they could have had wonderful lives, unbelievable lives. There would have been no Jordan River to cross. There would not have been the extra 38 years of aimless rambling and wandering around. There would not have been the death of millions, that whole first generation. Who could see the glory of the land right before them. They could see that it was true, that it was a land flowing with milk and honey. It reminds me of the old poem by James Russell Lowell. You ever hear of him? I know most of you are not poets. I'm not either, really, but the poem goes, once to every man and nation comes the moment to decide. In the strife of truth with falsehood, for the good or evil side. And that's exactly where these people are at. As soon as they hit Kadesh Barnea, it's decision time. And it's amazing to me how many of these poets and playwrights and people good with prose and stuff, they kind of pick up on this concept. Shakespeare did, of all people. Shakespeare writes, there is a tide in the affairs of men, which taken at the flood leads on to fortune, but omitted, all the voyage of their life is bound in shallows and in the miseries. So whether a person will or not, life is interspersed. And for some of us, there are several of these critical hours of decision where you wind up fundamentally at a fork in the road. And which way are you going to go? And the way that you're going to go is going to may decide your fate for the rest of your life. You see, those moments just pregnant with the possibility of dreamed up opportunities that you had longed for yourself and that others had longed for you to experience. Like John Greenleaf Whittier said, "For of all sad words of tongue or pen, the saddest are these, it might have been." That's exactly where Israel's at. The nation is standing right at the apex, the moment of destiny, with a potential that could require age upon age to tell about it. I mean, it would have been so glorious for them. And they make the mistake. They make one mistake, and the die is cast. And who knows how many generations are going to pay the penalty. So, 420 years before this, God had promised Abraham a seed and a land. And we hear repeatedly about those two things within the Abrahamic covenant. God was going to give these people their own home, a piece of terra firma they can call their own. They'd have a king in righteousness to rule over them. And the result would be blessing, not just to them as a people, but to the entire world. Land, seed, blessing. That was God's unconditional promise to Abraham. And from that very small beginning, and what appeared to begin as a very precarious type of providence, Abraham's seed now reaches an astounding number. They're around 600,000 strong in fighting men. Okay? You add to that the women, the children, and the adult men who are either too old or too lame to fight. You add all those into the mix, and we're looking at around 3 million folks at this time. So the seed and the land had been separated. the inhabitants and the actual terra firma, there was a gap between those two things for four generations. And the time that was spent in Egypt, God used that as a furnace of affliction to prepare these people for the absolute destiny to which he had called them. And as Israel's children labored and suffered and groaned under their taskmasters, the darkness of their night and the seeming hopelessness of their condition caused them to, in total immaturity, revive this pathetic hope that had been kept alive from generation to generation, that maybe they can go back to Egypt, which would have supplanted the hope that they had begun to get early on, that they would actually have a land of promise flowing with milk and honey for themselves. So I think that we can safely surmise that this hope had been kept alive. You can just imagine what would have happened as soon as they found out about it. Fathers and grandfathers, they would, tell the story to their kids of the land of promise. Someday God's going to give us this land. And the young, you can see the kid on the granddad's lap, and he'd be bouncing him on his knee as he's telling him about how great it's going to be for God's people, how they're the most privileged people on earth. And that was true. And the young boy's heart would burn. Oh, I hope that I can live to see my king someday, the king of Israel. Oh, I hope I could see him. And they would listen and listen, and they would tell it again and tell it again. And it became the favorite story of the home. And every Jew was born with this. This is what they lived for, this land flowing with milk and honey. And they'd go to bed at night, and occasionally they'd get waken up, or these restless dreams would kind of rule the night for them. And, the hope deferred, as the old cliche says, would make the heart sick. Oh, that we had our land and our king. Many times some new form of cruelty in their slave experience made them even more hungry and more eager to be in the favored generation. that they maybe they would be the ones that would, according to the divine promise, be led out of Egypt and enter Canaan's fair and happy land. Well, they are. The day arrived. Power of Pharaoh broken supernaturally. There they are at Sinai, and the law is given. And it's there at Sinai that the children of Israel, that's where they stayed while the wilderness tabernacle was being set up. Evidently, Moses got out that element that's within the book of Exodus. He got those two guys that were highly skilled, and they start building the tabernacle. They start putting the thing together while the rest of the nation is hanging out at the foothills of Sinai. And the end of the second year, after many trials and significant failures, now they're right at, they're 100 yards away from the finish line, Kadesh Barnea. And those hopes, long deferred, they're about to find fruition. That's the way it looks. Eyes of the people could, for the first time, see what their hearts had been longing for, at least what some of their hearts had been longing for. Certainly the remnant's heart was longing for it. It must have been a breathtaking thing. You know, the scene would have been to them something magnificent, beyond description. And this nation here standing at the moment of crisis. And just one bold thrust forward, and they would get into that. You know, it's like crossing the finish line, and you're just exhausted, and you're just full of joy because the race is over, and you won, you see. But the answer was, I mean, what are they going to do? What are they going to do? Well, the answer, you could have predicted the answer based on their behavior the last 2 years, especially in the first 3 months. Unbelief is the thing that characterizes this people, really almost immediately from the time they're leaving Egypt. Unbelief. And it's the same unbelief that's going to assert itself when they're at this crisis now, this crisis slash opportunity moment that's not going to last forever. Instead of pushing forward with all of the assurance in their heart that God's word was true, that God can be trusted, they falter. At first sight, it may have appeared as if the sending forth of the 12 spies to search out that land, it almost looked initially like, well, that might have God's approval, that the hand of God might be on this thing. In fact, you don't have any rebuke about it until you get to Deuteronomy and you find out what God really thought about it. In fact, it doesn't take long into Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 1, you learn there that this whole idea originated in their sin-filled hearts, and it certainly wasn't the will of God. In fact, in verse 22 of Deuteronomy 1, it says, "And ye came near unto me, every one of you, and said, We will send men before us, and they shall search us out the land." So, as is usually the case, God allowed an activity that was compatible with his permissive will. It wasn't his final will for them, but he allows things to happen. He permits Israel to send out those spies. And God appeared to Moses in Egypt. He'd made it clear he had a purpose to lead these people to the inheritance that he had ordained for them. Just like in verse 8 of Exodus 3, way early in the book of Exodus. "I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians," God says. He's telling Moses this. And to bring them up out of the land unto a good land and a large, unto a land flowing with milk and honey. That was his objective before they even got out. He told that to Moses. Moses told that to Pharaoh. But they got to have spies. See, this is really our problem, all right? See, this summoning of these spies, this electing of these spies was really the equivalent of all of them saying, "We cannot accept the veracity of the description of the land of Canaan that God gave us. We have to have it confirmed by man." Without saying it, that's what the spies were saying. And this is the chronic problem with the human condition. Men have always found it extremely hard to just rely on the bare naked word of God alone. Where human experience and human vision really ultimately dominate. How many people have any of us really ever known that were bastions of faith and conducted their lives in a way that was actually truly by faith and not by sight? Very, very few. Very, very few. True faith, friends, is not even in existence when it interprets God through circumstances, which is what these people are doing. If you're going to interpret God through circumstances, what you're really doing is you have a faith that interprets circumstances through a vision and realization of God, you see. That's what really needs to be taking place, but it seldom ever does. Weak faith. A weak faith always has to be bolstered by human investigation and proofs. Give me a sign. Give me a proof. That's either weak faith or no faith at all. In fact, the Lord Jesus had something to say about that, didn't he? An evil generation looks for that kind of thing. Verse 17, you still in Numbers 13? Are you in Numbers 13, verse 17? They choose 12 spies out, one from each tribe, and they commission these guys to go out, spy out the land, and we have the whole sad account beginning in verse 17 of Numbers 13. And Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan, and said unto them, get you up this way southward, and go up into the mountain, and see the land, what it is, and the people that dwelleth therein, whether they be strong or weak, few or many. Make calculations. Take notes. Verse 19. And what the land is that they dwell in, whether it be good or bad, and what cities they be that they dwell in, whether in tents or in strongholds. Verse 20, and what the land is, whether it be fat or lean, whether there be wood therein or not. Be of good courage and bring up the fruit of the land. Now the time was the time of the first ripe grapes. They didn't need to have any of that. God already told them the way it was going to be. So the question is, why these are people of faith, then why do they need spies? Why? See, this is exactly what Paul is trying to get across to Christians when he says, we walk by faith and not by sight. This is exactly the opposite of what's going on at Kadesh Barnea. And so for 40 days, it's interesting how that number 40 keeps cropping up again. For 40 days, these men spy out the land. And there's all kinds of reconnaissance going on, right? And in that reconnaissance, they had gone literally from one end of the promised land to the other. This was the first tour de force of Israel. I would have loved to have been there. I would have loved to have seen what the land looked like as God described it in those days. And I would like to have been a fly on the cloak of one of those guys just so I could see the land myself. But to all intents, they investigate and... they're investigating in order with the hope of being able to verify the things that God had said instead of just taking God at his word. That's what real faith would have done. So 2 years of experience should have taught them that God was absolutely, unbelievably, overwhelmingly able and willing to provide for their every need, to meet every conceivable emergency as he had already done in an overwhelmingly spectacular way. Those 2 years were filled with that kind of evidence in more ways than one. And that very same God could have met whatever problem they might have encountered as they stepped into the land by faith, based on what he said. In fact, the writer of the Hebrews comments on this. In chapter 3, in verse 17, he says there, listen, but with whom was he grieved 40 years? Was it not with them that had sinned, whose carcasses fell in the wilderness, and to whom sware he that they should not enter into his rest, but to them that believed not? So we see that they could not enter in because of unbelief. That's the New Testament commentary on this passage. So true faith, listen, is never, ever governed by circumstances. Never. Or by the often mysterious nature of divine providence. It is determined by reliance on God himself. Faith has to have an object. Faith always rests in a person. And you either have it or you don't. Because without faith, it is impossible to please him. Impossible. Say, well, I just, you know, I had my finger up in the air and, well, don't think you're pleasing God, because you're not. So the 40 days are over. The spies come back and make the report. And they announce what they found. And their report is not based on what they saw, because they couldn't. I mean, they got guys carrying these huge, humongous grapes that make those beautiful big grapes in the Pike Place Market look like garbage. So they can't report on what they saw. Their report is a false interpretation. They brought with them a bad hermeneutic into the situation. That's exactly what they did. They interpreted the facts of their experience. And so 10 of the spies bring the majority report. We're in big trouble. That's their report. Evil, the Bible calls it an evil report. And you can see it in verse 26, Numbers 13. And they went and came to Moses and to Aaron and to all the congregation of the children of Israel into the wilderness of Paran to Kadesh, and brought back word unto them and unto all the congregation, and showed them the fruit of the land. That must have been a sight. And they told him and said, we came unto the land whither thou sentest us, and surely it floweth with milk and honey, and this is the fruit of it. Nevertheless, so far so good, until you get to the nevertheless. The people be strong that dwell in the land, and the cities are walled and very great. And moreover, we saw the children of Anak there. You know, those big giants that we heard about back in Egypt. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites dwell in the mountains, and the Canaanites dwell by the sea and the coast of Jordan, and the place is just full of enemies. So they're willing to admit that the land was everything that God had said it was. They had the evidence to prove it. They brought it back with them. All you had to do was look at the grapes of Eshcol there. They admitted it was a land flowing with milk and honey, verse 27. But you get that nevertheless. The towns are walled, there's giants. And we're just grasshoppers compared to them. So we were in their sight, verse 33. And there have been a lot of grasshopper Christians through the years. So what the 10 spies did, with the bad report, the majority report, they made an interpretation of God in light of the circumstances. Except for Caleb and Joshua. They're going to interpret circumstances in the light of God's word. That's the difference between the majority and the minority reports. See verse 30? And Caleb stilled the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and possess it, for we are well able to overcome it. Oh, you want to applaud this guy? Let's go get the land. It's a great man. I remember being discouraged my first year in seminary. I went in guns blazing, and within a month I was depressed because 25% of the student body that didn't even belong there. I thought I was going to be with all these spiritual superstars, and I was young myself in the Lord. I really was. I wasn't a newborn, but I was. I needed to grow up a little bit myself. And then I go to chapel one day, and Oscar Haig preaches on Caleb, on that very text. Taking the land. And I got so far. I mean, if I heard that sermon today, I would probably say, well, it probably wasn't really very well done. But at that time, it was. And I determined, I said, I'm going to go with God no matter what happens to me, no matter, I don't care if I wind up in the gutter, eating insects for the rest of my life. I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to do it to the best of my ability. I'm going to do it right. And God has never let me down yet. That was back in 1986 that I made that decision, when I was about to quit. Because I'm looking around me at the circumstances, and I'm seeing these phony balonies. They want to be pastors. I wouldn't even let you into my church, let alone let you be my pastor. So God took care of me and gave me the faith that I needed to continue. That was a long time ago. That was a long time ago. So Joshua and Caleb, they saw the exact same difficulties that these other people saw. Only they're looking at them through a totally different lens. They're looking at them through the lens of faith, not the potentiality of a bad outcome regarding the circumstance. You see. And these two phrases, they stand out in the Minority Report. At once. All right? And we are well able. That's such great stuff. Nobody else is saying that. These are the only two guys making that statement. That's the difference between defeat and failure. It is. Here's everybody else. They're bigger than us. They're stronger than us. Verse 31. Joshua and Caleb said, "We are well able, because God said so." It was true then, it's true today. That's why John said, I think that a lot of our New Testament is written with these things in mind. For example, in 1 John 4:1, when the apostle says that ye are of God, little children, and ye have overcome them, because greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. That's exactly this scenario, right? But where did that come from? That's exactly what's going on here. Two guys out of millions are making that decision. There's another distinction between the evil and the good reports. One involves ownership with no hope of possession, and the other involves ownership with the assurance of possession. And so the ten, you know, by right of a divine gift, they own the land, but they have no desire to possess it. Here's Joshua and Caleb. They're in favor of turning ownership into possession. Right? Very few Joshua and Calebs in the world. Very, very few. Very few. Very few Christians ever possess their possessions. And the writer of the Hebrews says that. He says in Hebrews 3:19, he says they could not enter in because of unbelief. It's the greatest enemy. That's the sin that so easily doth beset us. That's what it is. You just flat don't believe. You don't believe that God's watching every move you make. You don't believe he knows every heart that you ever thought in your heart. Every thought you ever thought in your heart, he knows every bit of it. You don't believe that. In order to possess our possessions, we have to move in and stake out our claim. That's what we need to do. And so you can ask the question, how extensive are our possessions? Well, the Bible says all things are yours. All that Christ is, we are in him. And there's just one secret. What's the secret? You either have faith or you don't. You either exercise faith or you don't. So accept that as true. And if it's in the book and designated to you as a believer, you can make application. You can. God said it. I believe it. That settles it. I don't like cliches, but that's a good one. That is a good one. I mean, it was sad enough for the ten to be affected, but the real tragedy lay in the fact that the influence it had on the rest of the nation. The whole nation is affected because they're so gullible. So pathetic. Look at verse 26. And they went and came to Moses and to Aaron and to all the congregation of the children of Israel under the wilderness of Paran to Kadesh, and brought back word unto them and unto all the congregation, and showed them the fruit of the land. They influenced the whole course of the nation. And all the, look at chapter 14, verse 1. They hear about these giants and all this other problem. And all the congregation lifted up their voice and cried, and the people wept that night. You mean millions of people are weeping? Yes. Because of one little bad report, despite what God had already told them. We learned in Romans 14 that none of us liveth to himself, and no man dieth to himself. Everything that you're doing or not doing is affecting somebody else. Did you know that? You think you live in a vacuum? Everything you're doing or not doing is affecting somebody else. Everything. So we're confronted with this very solemn thought, I would say, of our responsibility. We have a responsibility with respect to this thing of faith. So the evil report is over. It's been rendered. And rebellion breaks out. You would have think that someone arose up and said, we don't accept that. We accept what God says. That didn't happen. In order for Caleb to give his report, we're told that he stilled the people before Moses, chapter 14, verse 30. And then bedlam reigns. The mob takes over. Mob psychology takes over. Look at verses 2 and 4, chapter 14. Verse 2, and all the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron. Why? Because they heard a little baby report. And the whole congregation said unto them, would God that we had died in the land of Egypt. How pathetic is that? That's worse than these impeachment trials going on. Or would God we had died in the wilderness. They didn't mean a word of that. They're too self-centered. They didn't mean that. That's just smoke. And wherefore hath the Lord brought us into this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and our children should be prey? Oh, mercy. They're blaming God for it. Were it not better for us to return into Egypt? And they said to one another, and see, this is how it goes. You know, they start talking to each other. Let us make a captain and let us return into Egypt. So in desperation, you've got Joshua and Caleb, two studs, trying to save the day in this horribly crucial hour. In fact, that's what they're doing. Verse 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, Joshua and Caleb are trying to save the day. They're so outnumbered. And instead of listening to them and admiring them as the men of faith that they actually were, you get the sad answer in verse 10. But the congregation bade stone them with stones. They want to stone the only two decent guys among them. Now, mark my word now, folks. God has never, ever, ever, ever majored with the majority. If you're in the majority, you better take a triple check of where you're at, because you're probably with the wrong crowd. I mean, a lot of churches have been destroyed. You got the godly remnant, and their hearts are broken by these conditions where reason is dethroned and prejudice and sinful passions rule the day. It's happened again and again and again. And the contrast is always between faith and human sentiments. And when that happens, truth rarely prevails. Rarely. The bad churches keep getting bigger, and the small ones keep getting smaller. Not in every situation, but that's generally the way it is. The remnant stays the remnant. And so Joshua and Caleb, they've got to encounter in their day what really any true witness has had to face in every succeeding generation. All right? They're in the minority, and they've got to listen to a multitude of voices raised against them. And Joshua and Caleb, they're calm, they're brave, they are studs for God, and all these other maggots are just agitated by their own sin. Unbelievers who are going to pay the consequences for their own wicked choice. So what are the results of all this? Well, first of all, everybody over 20 years of age dies. They don't get in. Too late. Second, they're doomed to a life of wandering before that happens, most of them for 38 more years, wandering around aimlessly. Total failure. And third, Canaan is lost. Even though the people repented after they saw what they'd done, they repented after the failure. Too late. They have to live with their bad decision. They had missed so much. All they had to do was go in. That's all they had to do. Obey God. I mean, think about it. So near. They're 100 yards away. And most of them die. They never make it in. Pathetic. They all could have gone in. All of them. Just like every one of them made it through the Red Sea. Same thing. So there's a very true sense that every single one of us stands one day at our Kadesh Barnea. Some of us get more than one. There's several crises in our lives. And it doesn't last forever. God gives you a little bit of time. Make a decision. Make a decision. You get a little bit of time to do that. What are you going to do with your decision? What are your children going to do with the decisions they made? What about your parents? What about your friends and loved ones? And you stand at the fork in the road of a way that will hold for you either unlimited potential for greatness and joy and peace, or for total devastation and depression and sadness and grief. I mean, decisions, somebody has well said, decisions are the hinges on which the doors of destiny turn. And for all the unsaved people in the world, it can be the door of heaven or it's the door of hell. It's the door of faith or the door of despair. And everybody is making a decision. There's no such thing as neutrality on this. No such thing as neutrality. So, I love the Old Testament. The lessons in the Old Testament are more vivid to me than the applications in the New. But they're for our admonition. Okay.